The views expressed in this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware.
WVUD and UD Information Technologies present Campus Voices, conversations with University of Delaware faculty, staff, and students about their teaching, research, service projects, and other interests. To introduce today's guest, here's your host, Richard Gordon, manager of the IT Communication Group at the University of Delaware.
Thank you, Jason. And joining us today on Campus Voices, we have Professor Christina Archer from the College of Earth, Ocean, and Environment from the School of Marine Science and Policy. Thanks for joining us, Christina.
My pleasure.
And around here, you're known as the Wind Lady.
Indeed. Rumors spread.
But it's not because, you know, students are dissing the way you teach or anything. It's because you are a big proponent of wind power as a renewable resource.
Yeah, I definitely think it's a wonderful renewable energy source. It's a wonderful energy source. I am a proponent in the sense that as a scientist, I have studied it and I've really concluded that it's a very good idea to have more wind in our system.
It's a renewable resource. It's not one that uses anything up.
In a sense, it does use a little bit of materials. You know, you need to build the turbines, you need some cement, you need some carbon fibers, and obviously that takes energy and that takes a material to build. But the beauty is that other than that, you're not combusting anything, you're not burning anything when you're operating the turbines. So the only pollution, and that is very little, the only little pollution that they produce is during manufacturing and installation. And after that, these are very clean machines that don't generate any pollution. So that is wonderful.
Is the potential there really to generate enough electricity for the modern world, or is it just an extension of the good old windmills?
It's such a good question, and people maybe don't realize how much wind actually is out there. And if I told you, yes, there is a lot of wind, enough for our energy needs, enough for 10 times our energy needs, would you be happy? I can go higher. It's actually enough to cover 30 times or more the world's energy needs. So it's really a very, very abundant resource. So you don't have to worry about running out of wind or running out. It's not possible. It's just not going to run out, and there's plenty of it anywhere.
Is it a relatively efficient method of capturing kinetic energy and storing?
You can capture it with a variety of technologies. As you probably know, the most conventional form of a wind turbine is the horizontal axis one with three blades, and most of us have seen them. And I think that is the most efficient design there is. And we've done all kinds of improvements to, you know, blades and generators and, you know, friction inside. So they're actually very efficient. But sometimes efficiency is not the whole story. You can go with maybe less efficient turbines, like vertical axis turbines. These look more like egg beaters. And around here, people may have seen them on the stadium in Philadelphia. They're actually all over the stadium. They're not that efficient, but the good news is that you can easily build them and embed them in the building, and you can pack them. So they're not that efficient, but you can put a lot of them on a given area, and so you can still get a very good return of your investment.
So what you're talking about there is using these vertical packed ones, as you said, so that it brings some energy relief to a big structure.
Definitely. And my understanding for the Philadelphia Stadium is that they are at the borderline of actually almost becoming a power plant. They're producing so much, even though it's not efficient, but they have so many turbines that they're almost a power plant. They can't have any more. If they have one more turbine, then they're going to become a power plant on the grid. So,
how are these turbines different than the old windmills that, you know, you think about in Europe, you know, running the grist mill, or in the American West, you know, running the pump out there for the cows?
Well, amazingly, the basic principles are actually the same. It's just been an evolution of the design and the technology to make it more efficient. But all you need is basically some blades. You need some area to be exposed to the wind, and you need to create rotation from that push from the wind. So really, the basic design is the same. It's just been perfected and made better with lighter materials, more resistant, you know, bigger areas, taller turbines, and so on.
So it's the same old technology, but made much more efficient.
Made better, yes. So, kind of like your car, right? Isn't our car the same as those carts or like in the old West with horses? In a sense, yeah, it's the same old technology, just became better.
Well, I still drive a Stanley steamer, you know, with the wood fire. No, I don't. Well, where are wind turbines deployed right now? I mean, we don't see them off the coast of the United States, but we do see them in other parts of the United States and other parts of the world. Where are they pretty heavily used?
Yeah, the good news is that humans have been very smart about where to put their turbines. And so they have the tendency has been to pick the best spots. So the first spots that have been developed have been the windiest, which makes a lot of sense. And so those locations are kind of like everywhere. But in the U.S. specifically, it's in the Midwest. We have a lot of potential, you know, the Dakotas, Texas. Very, very windy spots there. So not surprisingly, those states have a lot of power, Texas especially. Worldwide, they're everywhere. Germany, Great Britain, Denmark is the nation with the most offshore wind. Offshore wind is something that we don't really have in the U.S. just yet, even though we are so lucky and we have possibly the best offshore resource worldwide. With our two coasts, especially the Northeast and the Northwest, are blessed with very strong and very steady winds. It's just that it hasn't developed yet. It hopefully will happen soon. And the reason why it hasn't developed yet is mostly due to costs. Offshore wind is a little costlier to install, as you can imagine. It can be 2 times more expensive than the same turbine onshore. If you can imagine how long it takes to bring the turbine on a boat and, you know, build the foundations in the water, it's definitely more expensive. But the good news is that in general, offshore for the same latitude, you get stronger winds. So it's a good idea.
I know that I think I told you when we met last week that the two places I've seen, I first saw wind turbines were when I was visiting a family outside Nuremberg, Germany, and like that trip up from Munich to Nuremberg, and I see these individual turbines off in the hills. And now when I go visit my son in Pittsburgh, as I drive across the Pennsylvania Turnpike, I mean, you come on certain areas where they are, again, up on the top of hills. Now, those tend to be pretty, they look to me as a amateur that those are pretty solitary, but they're really up there in a pattern, aren't they?
They tend, you want to put your turbines in the best spots. So I'm not surprised that they tend to be on the crest of ridges and mountains. And, you know, the mountains are uneven terrain, so it's not very easy to build. So a limited amount of money, you build on the top so you get the best wind. So there's always a reason why they might be where they are. If you have, of course, a flat terrain with easy access and you want to build more turbines, then you build a farm. And in a farm, you can be smart about where you put the turbines as well, taking into account the fact that each turbine that is built behind one and it's located downwind of a given turbine will have a little less wind than the turbine upwind, actually a lot less wind, depending on how close it is. And so you have to be smart about where you place your turbines within a wind farm.
So it's almost like what I've seen, what they've done is they've put these individual turbines up in a pattern on different crests of hills so they don't block each other on different hills or mountains.
That sounds right.
But on building a farm in either offshore, like they've done in Europe, or I think China now too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or out in the Midwest of the United States, what are some of the things that people do? I mean, we're used to seeing them lined up, but it's you end up staggering them in some kind of unique way?
Yeah, that's actually a very good thing to do, because initially the first farms were kind of like, yeah, I'm going to draw some lines and I'm going to line up my turbines because it's easier to design and we don't really know much about wake losses anyway. Wake losses are this idea that I mentioned earlier, that a turbine downwind feels and therefore produces less power than the turbine upwind. It's called wake losses. And so at first, there wasn't too much attention to that. But now people are becoming smarter and they're noticing all these wake losses problems. And so we're trying to design the farm in such a way that you avoid these wakes and staggering them. So staggering means that instead of aligning the turbines one behind the other perfectly on a line, you kind of move them a little bit to the side on, you know, to the left or to the right, so that each wake does not impact the turbine behind. So this is it's a good technique to minimize losses.
I guess one of the things you need to do when you're designing a wind farm is look at where the prevailing winds will tend to stay in a steady direction.
Yes. It's very important to know the meteorology. So I'm a meteorologist. I studied meteorology. And of course, I'm going to tell you that the meteorology is the most important thing to know about a wind farm. Definitely, you need to know where the winds come from. And chances are there will be a predominant wind direction. Most of the time there is. Usually there are two of them. So there might be a predominant wind direction, for example, on the East Coast. In the summertime, it tends to be from the southwest. In general, not all the time, but in general. And in the winter, it's more like from the northwest. So there are two predominant wind directions that you want to take into account when you design. So make sure that whatever design you pick works well for those two directions, because they're the most common, the most likely to happen.
And of course, along the northeast United States, about twice a year, we get hit with a strong northeaster.
Oh, yeah.
What happens to a wind farm when something like that happens, when really strong wind comes in from a direction that the wind farm's not set up for?
The turbines are actually pretty resilient, and they are designed to withstand strong winds. And the design of the farm doesn't really impact whether turbine will make it or not. It's not a problem. It's not an issue. The good news is that I'm actually doing some research right now that shows that a wind farm, especially offshore wind farms, which are located in the water in front of cities, can actually protect those cities from the damage of hurricanes or strong winds. Winds such as nor'easters. And the reason, again, resides in these wakes that form for under very strong wind conditions can spread downwind over relatively wide areas, which means that downwind of an offshore wind farm, so you're in a city, you have an offshore wind farm offshore in front of you, and a hurricane is coming, the wind that you will feel because of the presence of a farm is actually much weaker. I mean, it can be like substantially weaker than the wind you would have without that farm. And wow. As a consequence, if that's not good enough, because the winds are weaker, the storm surge, which is this sea level rising during the storm, it's caused by the storm and the flooding that goes with it, are substantially reduced too. I mean, I'm talking about 50% reductions of storm surge. So not like a few centimeters or a few inches. We're in the order of feet of water that is not going to flood your house. So it's a really new and unique research that I'm doing. I'm very excited about it. So I'm glad you brought it up.
So even if the wind is coming from a way you've not designed it to maximize the collection of energy, it still can have benefits.
Oh, yeah. And, if you really want to protect your city with wind farms, if that's what you want to do, you probably want to design your farm to actually have as much wake loss as possible, which is the opposite of what you would do now. Right now, you want to maximize production, so you want as little wake losses as possible. But when a hurricane comes, you actually want as much loss as possible so that the winds are reduced. I'm not saying that we should, but it would be a different approach to the design, definitely.
I think you were telling me last week when we met that these decisions about managing wake loss affect the efficiency of a wind farm by about 2% or so, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it still can be the difference between making a profit, making it viable or not.
Definitely. And actually, there can be even more. The staggered design sometimes for a predominant wind direction can even save you 13 to 30%. So it's really a lot. Although, again, you have to take into account other wind directions, etc. So definitely 2 to 10% is a reasonable number. And when you have a wind farm that produces, gigawatt hours and gigawatt hours of energy, that 2 to 10% is in the order of millions of dollars per year. So it's definitely not peanuts.
I'm going to ask a really naive question because I just don't understand.
Those are the hardest.
Because I don't understand the technology in full, and I bet a lot of our listeners don't. So if you set up a turbine to be facing to maximize wind from the southwest, is it still generating electricity if a wind comes from the southeast or the northeast?
Oh, very good question. And I know the answer. Usually these general questions are so hard. I should have probably mentioned to you that turbines today can actually yaw. So they can be rotated in such a way that their blades always face the wind. So if you have a wind farm with a certain configuration and the wind is from the predominant wind direction, all the turbines are facing that direction. And then the wind shifts and then all the turbines automatically will turn to face the wind.
So like boats in a harbor that swing on their mooring to face into the wind.
Yes, except that I don't know boats very well, but to turn a turbine, you actually need energy. So it's not that the wind does it. You actually need to have a control and you need to have energy to actually turn them. So it's not like they turn all the time. You know, the wind is gusty, is turbulent. You know, it can change direction rapidly from a minute to the next. The turbines are not going to spin like crazy trying to orient themselves properly. They're more sensitive to changes that are kind of like significant, like the wind is shifting in the afternoon for the sea breeze, or, you know, a storm is coming and it's like substantial change, then they do turn.
We're talking with Christina Archer here on Campus Voices from the University of Delaware's College of Earth, Ocean, and Environment. And you can tell she's an expert in meteorology and been doing a lot of research on wind and wind power. When my son was a little guy, you know, one of the ways I dealt with him being afraid of thunderstorms was I bought him a little weather book. And,
oh,
you know,
cool.
we would sit down and go through it and look at things. I mean, so I think this is this topic of harnessing the wind is in itself fascinating to a lot of people.
Absolutely. But I think it's the way of the future, in a sense. Renewable energy is beautiful that way because it gives you the possibility to integrate your needs, your energy needs, and extract energy from the environment, but in a way that is not impacting it forever. You're not going to pollute the water. You're not going to cause spills. You're not going to cause nuclear accidents. It's just the wind. You're harnessing it. You stop harnessing it, the wind is back. It's just very natural and more integrated, I think, with nature.
What are some of the successes around the world? What have been some of the most successful deployments of wind power?
Oh, it's been very, very successful. I mean, in certain years, in the last 10 years, wind capacity has doubled, which means from 1 year to the next, the world has seen twice as many turbines as the year before in 1 year. Then, of course, there was the crisis, you know, the economic crisis in 2008, 2009, that affected wind as well. But it's back to a very good and nice growth. And right now, today, the U.S. is actually the second country in terms of installed capacity after China. China is actually number one with 75 gigawatts of installed capacity, and U.S. is number two with 60. So these numbers, they're big, I guess. You know, gigawatts means a billion watts. So 1 gigawatt is enough to power maybe a city. And so we have enough power to power 60 cities today in the United States. So that's not bad. Worldwide, it's about almost 300 gigawatts. So U.S. is almost 20% of the world's capacity. So that's kind of neat.
But all the U.S. installations, as you said, are on land.
I mean, all of them, yes, 100%.
Here in Delaware, we talk about, you know, offshore farms. We've got a turbine down on the Lewis campus, for experimental purposes. And we know that, you know, people up in Cape Cod are talking about offshore wind farms. Why is that not caught on here, but it caught on in places like Denmark?
Yeah. So, well, first of all, Denmark is a small country. And in general, in Europe, the government has more control and more long-term investments in what they do. In the U.S., there are states, so the federal government doesn't have that much power. And, of course, we change president every 4 years, so that has an impact on... It's very hard to do long-term investments.
And congressmen every two.
And there you go. And again, on top of that, there's also the states that have so much power, and there are several states, as you can imagine, as you know, along the U.S. East Coast. And so to depict the story of where offshore wind stands today, you really have to go state by state. There isn't a statement that works for everybody. So, for example, Cape Wind in Nantucket Sound, which is the first company that started proposing offshore wind over 10 years ago. They had a lot of opposition because of the beauty of the Cape Cod area and the wealth of some of the residents and the fact that it was a new idea at that time. So it's been 10 years, 10 years or more of work to try to develop that farm. They had 2 weeks ago a major new step approved, so they're getting closer and closer to actually putting turbines in the water. They already have a platform of measurements there that's been collecting data for over 10 years, and they are very close to starting to actually build. But then 2 weeks ago, again, in New Jersey, basically offshore wind has been turned down completely. So it will not happen in New Jersey. And so every state has its own developments and stories and successes and non-successes. So,
what is it that people object to with wind turbines? You told me an interesting story about when you lived out in California.
About my house.
And your neighbor's wind turbine.
Definitely, yeah. So I used to live in California in this beautiful neighborhood close to downtown, but at the same time more like a country living area in a canyon. And one of my neighbors, actually I was two properties away from it, so very close to their property, they had a residential wind turbine. So it's a small, it was maybe 30 kilowatt turbine. The cost was about $60,000. And I think the state gave the owners some, maybe half of it. So a good portion of the turbine was paid by the state. And it wasn't a particularly good spot. It wasn't that windy. But the guy was kind of happy to have it. And, you know, it was on a big lot of land. The turbine wasn't close to anybody. And the neighbors hated it. They hated this turbine. They felt that it was reducing the property value in the neighborhood. Some claimed adamantly that it was so noisy that they couldn't sleep at night. And I just didn't know what they were talking about because I was right there and our nights were perfectly fine and we could sleep no problem. It was the air conditioners or the crickets that were much noisier than the turbine. And the nice story is, I mean, it's not a success story for wind, but the neighborhood was so convinced that this was bad that they actually gathered money and paid the owner of the turbine to actually take it down. So they took care of all the demolishing costs. So they were that serious about not wanting it that they paid for it.
People really feel that way about these wind turbines.
I guess so.
I mean, you were telling me they're not really that loud.
No, they're not. And I know it from experience from my house in California, but also from the Lewis turbine that you mentioned earlier. You're welcome to go. It's on state land, and you can stay the night at the Verdon Center, which is the closest building aside from the university office and labs. You can stay the night and leave your windows open, leave your doors open. You'll be the closest person to the turbine. You'll hear it. Yes, you can, especially if you just shut up, everybody, let's listen, and you pay attention, you'll hear it. And then the crickets will dominate, and any car that drives by will be louder, and the air conditioner is louder. So
it's quieter than traffic sounds.
Oh, yes.
But people still object to it.
Well, it's just like an even, not even. And it's coming back at the same frequency, whoosh, whoosh, whoosh. So even though it's not loud, but it has a frequency that maybe your mind perceives, and so you kind of get, it's kind of like the drop from the faucet that has a harmonic continuous coming at the same pace.
That sounds like white noise that would help me sleep.
There you go. Yes. Try a train. I mean, a train by your house that all of a sudden out of the blue, whoom, there's this noise. So.
Now, you also mentioned that you thought your neighbor got some state subsidies, and mm-hmm. I know that that's been an issue that some people who oppose wind power talk about, how the wind industry or the solar industry depends on subsidies for success.
Yeah.
But that's really true of everybody in the energy business, isn't it?
Oh, my goodness. That's very true. And people maybe don't realize that it's not just renewable energy that gets subsidies. That's actually really, really a small amount of subsidies that we get. So between 2002 and 2008, for example, in the U.S., the federal subsidies to renewable energy were on the order of $30 billion. Whoa, $30 billion. That's a big number. Yes, sure. It's a big number. Guess what it was for traditional fossil fuels? Which are a well-established technology that petroleum, gas, coal. You know, you would think no subsidies for those, right? All those renewable energy expenses subsidies. Well, how about $70 billion? $70 billion.
So
six times more than renewable energy for a technology that doesn't really do they really need subsidies? I mean, it's so well established. We have all of our pipelines, we have our coal extraction, our mines, and you know, it's already cheap enough. So why on earth do we do subsidies? But we do. So if you build a coal power plant, the government guarantees 10% return on your investment. That's taxpayers' money to guarantee that. This is it's a sad story. It definitely, the subsidies are everywhere, and renewable energy is no better than, doesn't get any more subsidies than other technologies or energy sources.
So is that built into the profit plan, if you will, or the business plan for someone who wants to build a wind farm is...
It might be the way things are phrased. It might be whether you get the subsidy can take different forms. You know, it can be a tax break or a tax rebate or an incentive. But all of these, to me, classify as subsidies. So just because maybe for renewable energy, it's more explicitly stated as a subsidy, it doesn't mean that it's not there in the other sources of energy. Yeah, but they're definitely taken into account at business time, in a business plan.
One of the objections to wind turbines is the bird kill factor.
Indeed, yeah. I don't know. It feels like it's almost like a perception because Altamont Pass in California was one of the biggest farms in the world, actually, in 1985. That farm alone was half of the wind power in the world in 1985. It's located on a migratory path of bald eagles, I think, and other protected species. And so, unfortunately, a lot of birds, protected species in particular, were killed at that farm. And when I say a lot, I mean maybe one bird fatality per year or something like that. Nonetheless, being a protected species, that's a high number. And so it kind of gave that reputation to wind, but some recent studies that have just been completed, one, for example, by Benjamin Sobakul of the Center on Asia and Globalization, they actually found that basically wind energy kills less birds than anything else, which is kind of counterintuitive. So for each gigawatt hour of electricity that you generate from wind, they found maybe 0.3 to 0.4 avian fatalities, which is kind of like a funny number. So it's a third of a bird per gigawatt hour of electricity. But anyway, keep this number in mind, you know, a third of a bird per gigawatt hour of electricity. Fossil fueled plants, they actually cause 5.2 fatalities for that same gigawatt hour of electricity. And this is because you can't neglect the impact of mining, habitat destruction, acid rain, mercury poisoning, climate change. All of these words to you, you know, mercury poisoning, acid rain, they actually kill birds and a variety of other species, but birds too. So actually, it's almost like I can almost say wind turbines are really not that bad. 0.3 versus 5.2. It's really not true, I guess, that they kill birds. Maybe directly, you find the carcasses probably by wind farms, and you don't see them necessarily. You don't necessarily see how many birds are killed by climate change. But once you start calculating those indirect effects, it's actually almost a factor of 10. So wind turbines do not kill birds.
So you're saying that wind turbines don't kill birds, they don't make too much noise, and they're just getting a bad rap from people who are nervous about change.
I guess so. That's a good summary.
I sort of suspect that both the solar energy and industry and the wind power industry are sort of facing some of the same issues that other new industries are. There's a large investment already, large capital investment in a certain way of doing business, and this is a new way.
It's true. It's always more expensive to be the first one.
How expensive is it to construct, say, a 20-turbine farm? Or is that a fair question?
Yeah, I mean, it's very hard to give a number that works everywhere, obviously. On a flat terrain with easy roads, it's cheaper than on a mountain than offshore. But, you know, you can do something like, on average, maybe $2 million per megawatt, something like that. So if you have a 20-turbine farm and you have 1 megawatt per turbine, that would be $40 million. You probably... Right now, a 1 megawatt turbine is actually small, so they tend to be more like 3-5. So a 5 megawatt turbine is more like what it is today. So multiply that by 5, $40 million by 5, so $200 million, something like that is an order of magnitude of what it would cost.
So it would take some time to make that money back.
Yeah, not that long, though. Again, this really depends on, you know, where you are, etc., but it's on the order of a few years.
Okay, yeah. So it is a reasonable kind of thing to do.
So it's not 10 years, it's not 6 months. It's on the order of a few years to get your investment back, which is kind of cool.
I mean, that's very good.
Yeah. For solar panels and photovoltaics, for residential applications, you might not ever get it back. So I had some proposals done for my house, and there were some very... negative assumptions about how much electricity would cost in the next 10 years in order to make it self-sustained within 15 years. And it was really like, really? You know, growth of energy, electricity by 12% per year. I don't know about that. Or things like that. To you know, of course, the more the electricity costs, the more, the quicker you recoup your money. But
we're talking with you in the spring of 2014. Where do you think wind energy is going to be in the spring of 2024?
Well, there's a commitment at the federal level too, with the Department of Energy and some states as well, to try to reach 20% of the energy by wind by 2020. So we're trying to get there. I wish I remembered exactly where we stand today. I would say probably less than 5% in the U.S. So getting to 20% is, you know, kind of like quadrupling what we have today. So it's not an easy task, and it's already 2014. But hopefully we're going to get there by 2020. So not exactly 2020, maybe 2024. It will be even more realistic. That
well, it's interesting talking about this, because it, you know, the implications for everything that uses energy are so great. So that if we start getting 20 to 30% of our electricity from wind power, that implies that things like charging stations for electric cars might become more feasible.
Definitely.
Which would change the whole landscape of how America...
Not to mention that for every megawatt hour that comes from wind, there's one less megawatt hour that comes from a polluting source. So that's the beauty of it, too.
Oh, we could talk for another hour about this.
No, don't get me with electric cars. I can talk about that, too.
Christina Archer, thank you so much for stopping by.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices, a collaboration between WVUD, the broadcast voice of the University of Delaware, and UD Information Technologies. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official views or policies of WVUD, UD Information Technologies, or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices and to find archive copies of this and other episodes, visit our website. Using all lowercase letters, go to www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM, WVUD, and WVUD HD1 Newark, or online at wvud.org.